Spring into deals for seasonal savings. Shop select 1-pint annuals for just $1. Plus, get a free additional Cobalt 40-volt 2-amp-hour battery when you buy select Cobalt 40-volt trimmer and blower combo kit. Our best lineup is here at Lowe's. Lowe's, we help you save. Valid to 5/6. Annuals offer excludes Alaska and Hawaii.
Visit your nearby Lowe's on Silver Drive in Columbus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Save big money on everything at Menards. Take control of your outdoor space with Roundup, Weed, and Grass Killer. The Pump and Go container is ready and easy to use. With the Pump and Go sprayer, you don't need to mix your own liquid, and you get up to 10 minutes of continuous spray. Save big on Roundup, Weed, and Grass Killer. Plus, check out our flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now.
Save big money at Menards.
This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi, Stacy Cole, and Todd Michaels.
Monique Tepe spent 8 years knowing her ex-husband had allegedly threatened to kill her. According to the unsealed affidavit, witnesses told investigators McKee strangled her during the marriage, forced unwanted sex on her, and told her directly that he could end her life whenever he wanted. She divorced him in 2017. She never filed a public police report. She never obtained a protective order. She told friends and family she was afraid, and then she got up every morning and lived her life anyway. That's the part of this case that doesn't make headlines but matters the most. What does it cost to function, to work, to fall in love again, to raise children while carrying the knowledge that someone has promised to kill you? Siobhan Scott, psychotherapist and author, is with us. She spent over 30 years working with survivors of intimate partner violence in shelters and clinical settings. She's also a survivor herself. Her ex-husband died by revenge suicide after she asked for the divorce. She knows what it means to live under that shadow. Today, we are talking about the psychological burden Monique carried, why the people around her may not have fully understood it, and what it actually takes to survive when someone has made you a target. Siobhan's book is this one, Nightbird. It has her story in it of survival and of getting back to life. In it. Highly suggest checking it out. Nightbird, available wherever books are sold. Siobhan, as always, welcome. I always look forward to our conversations. Let's get into this. Strangulation, it's considered one of the most significant predictors of future lethality in domestic violence situations. At least one witness told investigators that McKee had strangled Monique during their marriage. This is always one that stands out to a lot of people as a huge red flag. Does it stand out to you as a huge red flag? And what does it indicate clinically about the dangers that she was in? And did she likely understand that danger herself?
Yeah, it is, as you say, the most telling sign of potential lethality. It's terrifying for the victim because the perpetrator is literally saying, I have your life in my hands, mm-hmm. and I can dominate you and control you. And it's terrifying to be in that situation. That's the kind of thing that never leaves you. You know, that trauma is stored in the nervous system. It's stored in the body, and it impacts a person forever. It leaves them with PTSD.
Let's talk about what a lot of people are looking back here on, and because it's all we have left to look back on is records of the situation, because obviously Monique and Spencer are gone. So what did they leave in the wake of their lives? And we, as far as we know, don't see police reports. We don't see complaints. We don't see really much of anything other than the divorce filing that Monique had, gone through and given to Michael nearly a decade ago, when they, supposedly settled all of that. Yet we have all of these stories from her family, from friends, that she lived in fear for all of these years, that these threats were very real, at least during the marriage. We don't know exactly what was said after the marriage, but that's something that a lot of folks are looking at and wondering, why wouldn't someone file complaints or something with authorities? Let's say, for example, if there were threats after the marriage, I kind of get like, it's settled law, it's settled case. Once that divorce is done, you don't necessarily need to go back and relitigate that. You hope that it's done when the divorce is there. But if there was more, and just speculating, if there was more, what would be the reasons that people don't go to law enforcement, that don't get this on the record, but deal with it themselves?
Yeah, about 50% of the time, restraining orders and contact with law enforcement will cause the perpetrator to stop.
Yeah.
Which is wonderful. But in the other categories, it about 20%, it makes no difference. They don't necessarily escalate, but they don't stop. But then they can get locked up and there can be legal consequences for it, of course. But in a small percentage of the cases, it can escalate the threat and make them more likely to act on the threat. And I think a lot of women intuit this. They just have a gut sense that he's going to get worse and get more dangerous if I make reports. So that would be my guess here, that she was a smart woman and she was just hoping that this would die down and he would move on and get in another relationship and maybe get the focus off her. But clearly that wasn't what happened.
Is that ever a good plan? Is it ever a good plan if you are getting threats, if you are getting stalking type behavior or something? Let's say he was communicating in some way, shape, or form in an unwanted way after the marriage, and she didn't report it. And I'm not faulting her, and I'm not faulting anybody who doesn't report this stuff. I want to be clear about that, because like you just said, 50% will stalk. It's like, you report it, you're rolling the dice here, and the dice aren't exactly in your favor. The way that this could roll out, when you have this person in your life, there's really not any good path that's going to come of this. And that, I think, is the reality. Number one, that somebody who's in that situation, is that what they need to accept? Because I feel like there is a lot of surprise that happens in situations like this, and maybe it shouldn't be surprises. There's a lot of putting your head in the sand sometimes. Let's just keep moving on and hope this goes away. There's a lot of everything other than actually accepting and dealing with the reality of the situation that one is in. Accepting out of the gate, if you have a character like this, number one, it's not your fault, but it doesn't mean just because it's not your fault that it's going away or that it's not there. That, I'm curious, at the beginning, should this be something that people just need to wrap their brains around? That if there's a person like this in your life, it's going to be a rough road, as shitty as it is, as much as you don't want it to be. It is what it is. You better figure out ways to deal with it effectively.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and a lot of women in these worst case scenarios with somebody who has such a potential for danger end up going into hiding, changing their name, leaving the state, erasing their social media presence, buying guard dogs, arming themselves. And I'm not saying that that's an immediate thing that everybody needs to do, but I have seen cases where people felt this person was so dangerous and was just not giving up and was making threats. Sometimes even when they get locked up for stalking, they are able to write letters to them from prison,
How is that possible? Siobhan, I don't mean to interrupt you, but if you're in prison for stalking and you've been convicted, how are you still allowed to contact that victim?
I think they're not supposed to, but how they, you know, and it's probably different in every jail or every prison, how people get letters out. I don't think it's always handled the same way. But I had one client who was getting letters from her abuser saying these veiled things like, I love you so much. I hope nothing ever happens to you. I hope someone doesn't do something to you. And it just terrified her. So yeah, this all needs to be dealt with in a very severe way.
I think the answer to how could they write a letter and they put it in the mail, and you're relying on Cletus at the mail department to catch it and go, oh, there's not supposed to be any contact there. And if that person has a no contact order and they're already in jail, they have nothing to lose, especially if they're already there for life. Oh, I shouldn't send that. Okay. Oops. One got out. I mean, you're relying on somebody catching it basically. And it's not always going to be the most reliable way. So, I mean, it's going to happen and people are going to do what they're going to do. I mean, just like this. So it is important to document though.
Yes.
And I think that is really key here. Again, we're not victim blaming, but if there was contact here, what, because we're all saying, you know, she did everything right. Did she? Did she do everything right? Should have this, let's say there was contact, should more of this been reported? What, and what would it have done, if anything?
My gut, I'm trying to put myself in her situation with this guy. My gut would have been report and be as aggressive as I could possibly get law enforcement to be with him.
Yeah.
He was trying to function as a professional. Could you have gotten, you know, the word to his licensing board? Mm-hmm. Could there have been more consequences for him? Because the longer it went on, probably he became emboldened over time and went on for years and there were never any consequences for him. So we can look back with hindsight and say, maybe it would have gone in a different direction. You know, they can put GPS trackers on people if they think they're going by your house and pick them up that way. And again, there are cases where people have tried that. It didn't work. But I think my gut would have been saying, I've got to get more aggressive with getting this guy locked up.
And then there's that boogeyman of, you know, if I start to escalate things to protect myself, am I escalating him?
Right.
And it's, I don't want to characterize and say it's always a man doing this, but I imagine the stats are heavily leaning toward male versus female.
Yes.
And so how do you not enrage that man that I'm going to come after you harder now because you're coming after me, especially him being a physician. If you're going after his license because of what he's doing in his personal time, wow, he looks like the type who would allegedly just become enraged by that.
Yeah. And that's a possibility. And I'm sure that was in her mind. And so it's such a judgment call. And that's, I think, where in working with a domestic violence advocate in your community, look at every possible resource, and including if you're still scared after 5 years, 8 years later, and you're noticing anything about this person, stalking, monitoring, those kind of things, I would really look at disappearing. You know, it's a life or death situation, which I think is horrible that victims have to even consider doing that. But I have seen people who did it.
Why don't we have more safeguards in place for situations like this? Is it, and I'm asking, I don't know the answer to this. I'm just asking, is it because the system is abused, because it has the potential to be abused by people who really want to just make life miserable for an ex? And I'm saying, if it were, the tables were turned here a bit, let's say McKee, and there's situations like this where, let's say McKee's just moved on with his life. He's not doing anything at all. And Monique has the grudge. Monique doesn't want to see him. And this is not this situation, but there are other ones where she's like, I'm just going to keep making life miserable because he was shitty to me in that relationship. Yeah. And I'm going to go after this and I'm going to go after that. I'm going to make these claims. It is, he said, she said, unless you can prove anything. So why? I mean, I guess, is that it? Is it because it can be abused? Because there's a potential for the abuse? Because it has been abused in the past? And if it has been abused in the past, is it at a level where that erring on the side of, well, we can't do a whole lot because other people could really abuse this or people could pull those levers? What is it? What's going on? Why do we seem to not have a very clear path to protecting anybody when they legitimately need it? And it seems to be that path, the roadblocks are up because we're afraid of blocking something, an error, basically. Mm-hmm.
I think we need more education in the court system about domestic violence. You know, there are judges that take it very seriously, and there are judges who don't, who will have more of that, oh, this is just he said, she said. And that's the importance of documenting everything and having witnesses and having evidence, having logs where you note the dates and the times, and you basically present something to the court that can convince them that this is credible. It's not just, you know, bitter feelings after a bad divorce. Mm-hmm. And yes, in bad divorces, people will make all kinds of accusations that aren't true. I've certainly seen lots of that. Mm-hmm. And it could be that certain judges just get really, you know, lax about it because they see so much where nothing really happens. It's just people fighting, and that mm-hmm. can go on for a long time.
And I mean, statistically, I mean, this is an outlier. It's not like everybody who goes through a bad divorce ends up being murdered. I mean, we're talking a very, very small percentage. So if every judge were to react, you know, it's easy to Monday morning quarterback this and go, well, they filed this, they could have done this or that. Like, yeah. Or absolutely nothing would have happened. A judge would have looked at it and went, he said these things. He lives 300 miles away. He hasn't done anything to you in 8 years. And what do you want me to do about it? I mean that really is the reality of the situation from what we know thus far. There could be more. We don't know. Is a recommendation every time report? I don't know the answer. I mean, if someone's in a situation, they feel like they're being stalked, they have evidence of it, more, not just feel. I want to take feeling out of this because you don't go on things just on feelings. Mm-hmm. You want to go on if there is evidence, if he is texting, if you got this, you got that. Yeah. Should all that be documented with authorities? Because I think, too, people should understand when you document something with authorities, doesn't mean they're always going to go in and do something to that person. Right. It gets on the record so that if they do something, they can go back to the record and go, oh, it looks like they called in a concern back here. Yeah. This seems to add to it.
You're building a case. You're building a case. And I think that's really an important part of it because judges, as you say, they don't know if people come in and make up awful things about their exes all the time. And judges sort of have to sort that out. And that's why you need the documentation. And, you know, you need law enforcement to go out and talk with these people when there are these breaches of the restraining order or whatever. There's a lot of other things that come to mind. I think if anybody had done a good psychological evaluation on this guy, you know, with psych testing, mm-hmm. I think they would have picked up on this is someone who really is dangerous and we need to keep closer tabs on this. And I don't know at this point that judges order that typically. If there's child custody involved, yes, you can get psychological evaluations ordered, and often then you get a report saying this person is legitimately dangerous and should not have contact with the children, and this woman is at risk. But I doubt that that's done very often in a case like this. If I had the magic wand, I'd say let's do testing on him.
I wonder, with him being a physician, if that might have cleared him, that he walks into a courtroom, maybe into a meeting with officials, and they're like, oh, he's a physician. Mm-hmm. You know, he's already passed every test. Mm-hmm. Our society elevates people in that field to such a godlike level that they look like they can't do any wrong. You know, here's a guy who's saving lives. Why would he ever be a threat to anybody? Mm-hmm. I just feel like he could have skated if they had started probing into him because of his profession.
Yeah. Yeah. Very true. I was asked once, by an attorney who was a defense attorney who was out of state. It was kind of this convoluted way I met him, but he said, would you come in and just talk, no testing, but just talk with my client who's been accused of domestic violence and kidnapping. And it was a federal charge because he took his wife, you know, it was, they were married, kidnapped her and took her over state lines. So it's this big case. Would you come in and just talk with him? He says he didn't do any of it. I'm just curious about your opinion. Mm-hmm. And I spoke with the guy for 15 minutes. And it was so clear to me that he did it. He still denied to me that he did it. But when I saw the way his thinking pattern was going and his personality structure, I was like, oh, hell yes, he did it. You know?
Yeah.
And I gave that.
He knew he did it though, right?
I mean, he knew he did it. He was psychopathic. He was calculating. And that leaked out very quickly in my interview with him. So.
It kind of brings to mind a little bit, and we haven't seen this yet in this case, but who knows if we will or not. We're seeing it over in the Koberger case right now, where there's a lawsuit against WSU for not taking action against Koberger sooner. There was 13 complaints over in that case about his uncomfortable behavior. Not necessarily a lot of it going into illegal territory, but enough where someone should have maybe been fired. Should we be doing more psych testing in general in areas, in certain professions? Maybe that is in places where you do hold someone's life in your hand. I don't know, like being a surgeon in the medical field, in the psych field, in the law enforcement. I would think there's just certain ones where we may want to do regular psych testing to make sure the folks that we have employed are still good and healthy mentally to be doing those jobs. And that may then be a point of contention of continued employment. I'm wondering here if that should be something that's done. And if it were to be done, what would it actually lead to other than maybe you don't get the job? Just because you fail the psych test doesn't mean, oh, well, it turns out you're kind of, you know, going over here into the dark triad of thinking. They can't just go and arrest you for that. Right. It would just push them, you know, probably somewhere else that's not going to be as strict on testing. But if we did more things like that, would that be beneficial to society? Again, there's, again, 1,000 ways that this could go. But what's your thoughts on that? Do we not pay attention? Do we not give enough attention to that in areas that may, you know, may put a speed bump in front of those who are not mentally well?
I sure would vote for that one. And of course, there would be civil liberties people who say that's invasive of privacy and you can't do things like that. And they would fight it in court. But, you know, to work in a nuclear power plant, you have to have a full battery of psychological tests because they want to make sure you're not going to go in and try to blow the thing up and that you're stable enough to be there. My late husband, the one that killed himself, he applied ironically as a job for a probation officer.
Oh, geez.
And he met the requirements. He did an oral interview. He was, you know, manipulative. So he aced the oral interview, but the final step before he got the job was psych testing. Mm-hmm. And boy, did he flunk that.
Yeah.
And that was when the psychologist who did the testing really nailed the cluster B traits and said, this is not an appropriate person. Well, when he was declined the job, he requested the copy of the psych testing, which they gave him. And that blew him up. Boy, he had a fit about that because he thought he could bamboozle everyone. He couldn't bamboozle the MMPI. So, yeah, he would have been a terrible person to be a probation officer.
What about this? I come up with 500 ideas how Tony saves the world today and fail at every one of them. Psych testing before marriage. People, the idea of doing that. I'm about to get married myself. I just wrapped up putting together my prenup. You know, that's kind of a thing that a lot of people, you know, it's optional, but, you know, a lot of people do. I've not heard of this being a normal thing in any sort of marriage or relationship.
But why not?
But
why the hell not?
I mean, I don't know that I'm going to, like, hey, honey, let's do a psych test. But I mean, it's not common. It's not normal. It would take a long time to be normalized. But imagine how many relationships could be not entered into.
Yes. What if Monique didn't enter into the relationship with him based on that? Tony, and I'm sorry for just like out of the blue, I just went, fuck! Because, if you have to go to church and sit down with the pastor and talk about, you know, how you're going to raise the kids, you should have one of these freaking tests.
It's one of the, it's kind of the engine that does everything and we ignore it. The psychology, the mental end of this is what is everything. And we just, we like to take a look at all of the other pieces of the puzzle, except the main engine. It's like, well, how are the amenities? Mm-hmm. Are those good? Not the actual fuel that keeps this thing going.
Yep.
We just hope, well, they seem like a lovely person. Why not evaluate that a little bit more? Why not make that more of a common thing? I mean, a lot of couples do like premarital counseling and things, not because they have problems, but because they want to, you know, iron out anything ahead of time. They want to go into it with the best foot forward. And a lot of couples are doing this. A lot of couples are going into relationships, doing a lot of pre-work before there's problems. So people have the appetite to be healthy, to go and enter into a relationship in a healthy way. Is this a thing, or did I just kind of pull that out of my ass and nobody's doing this?
I think you pulled it out of your ass, but I agree with you. It's a wonderful idea. And if I were ever, if my current husband, I don't plan to get out of this marriage, it's been 20 years, but if I were shopping, you know, the one thing I did before I married Mike, my spouse, is I did do the people search background check, you know, for criminal stuff, any arrests, there weren't any, looking at financial status, you know, have there been a bunch of bad debts or whatever. So I always encourage my clients to do that because sometimes they find things and it's, you know, it's scary because often another thing I tell people is you don't really know if you're with a good manipulator. It can take a couple of years before you start seeing signs that something is really wrong here, whether it's lying, whether it's money problems, you know. The other thing that would be lovely is, can we have a group with his exes where everybody sits in a room and talks about what was your experience with him? I think that would be.
Be a little hard to orchestrate.
But it's my fantasy. Yeah.
There's a great episode of Everybody Loves Raymond where every former girlfriend of Robert was put together. I don't know if it was Marie that put it together, the mother-in-law or the mother who was overbearing, but like four women sitting there talking about how bad Robert was in relationships. And he wasn't abusive. He was just a moron. He was just an idiot. But there should be some way for you to figure out what the person is really like when you're going into this huge relationship. Mm-hmm. We do it for jobs. Why don't we do it for marriages?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Another area that could be done on, I would also imagine dating websites. I mean, it would certainly, look, eHarmony used to kind of be like that about a decade or two ago. Yeah. It used to be, you're doing a 2-hour test.
Yeah.
I don't know how it is today. I haven't used it in decades, but it was almost like a psych test. And then it really was particular on who it matched you with. Mm-hmm. I feel like today, and I could be wrong about that, but when I was back on those sites, you know, a year or two ago when I was getting back into dating, it's very quick. It's more like, here's a few things about you. Here's some pictures. Good luck. If we had, and maybe this does exist, maybe I'm off, but if we had things like that, maybe some sites where it's like, and by the way, everyone has gone through a psych test and not everybody gets in, not everybody just gets on the site because they want to pay whatever. That might be another ticket to entry. It would probably be significantly priced, but it would be something where, okay, I'm going to go into this pool and at least, you know, the pool you're going into, at least, you know, there was a test done. Mm-hmm. How easy is it for someone kind of in the dark triad of personalities to fake their way through one of these tests, to manipulate it to get the type of results that they want?
They could certainly manipulate to a degree, mm-hmm. but that's where, and this is where it would get really expensive, and we probably don't have enough psychologists in the country to actually administer tests like that.
Yeah.
But if you go into tests like the MMPI, Minnesota Multiphasic Personality Inventory, the people who are trying to fake, mm-hmm. it catches it because there are lie scales built in. And that's one of the marvelous things about a good test like that mm-hmm. is people who are trying to game the test, they get flagged as dishonest. And so that's sort of the gold standard.
Fascinating. I'd love to get everybody's thoughts on that in the comment section on YouTube or on our Substack. The links are in the description. Michael McKee pled not guilty to two counts of aggravated murder. The state says they have surveillance footage, a ballistics match, a cell phone that went dark during the murder window, years of documented threats. McKee's response wasn't to negotiate. It wasn't to collapse. He waived his bail hearing, but reserved the right to revisit it. A chess move, not a surrender. There's a type of defendant who treats the courtroom like an arena, not a place of accountability, but a final stage to prove mm-hmm. what they've always believed about themselves, that mm-hmm. they're smarter than everyone else in the room. Mm-hmm. Ted Bundy represented himself and cross-examined witnesses. Scott Peterson watched his own trial like a spectator as someone else's tragedy. Chris Watts tried to con homicide detective days after his family was dead. What connects these defendants isn't just what they allegedly did. It's how they process being caught. Siobhan Scott is with us, author of The Minds of Mass Killers, to help break all of this down. Let's get into this a little bit deeper on the forensic side of it. You've evaluated people who've committed various types of serious violence. When someone faces substantial evidence and pleads not guilty anyway, what's typically driving that decision? Is it legality, psychology, both? Are they just along for the ride at this point if they know they did it? What do you think is going on here?
It seems to usually be a legal maneuver. And I have seen cases where people, the evidence was overwhelming, and I think they were probably not terribly narcissistic and psychopathic, mm-hmm. and they didn't want to go through the whole process. They had basically accepted reality, which is a good sign, mm-hmm. and they do a plea bargain. And mm-hmm. so I think a lot of that happens. But if you have the narcissistic, strongly narcissistic, psychopathic person, yeah, they look at the court proceedings as a challenge. And it is their stage. And they honestly think a lot of the time that they're going to bamboozle everybody. And look at me, I'm smarter than all of you.
Yeah. Is that like a legit, I mean, like, are they really thinking at the end of the day, I'm going to convince them that, like a case like this, I mean, I'm baffled when you look at the evidence. If it all holds up, you know, obviously the prosecution here, the DA, they're going to lay out this mountain of damning stuff. And we've seen many cases where at the end of the day, some of it crumbles, some of it doesn't quite add up to be what it's proposed as being out of the gate. But let's just assume it all stands. And we have this mountain of damning evidence that pretty much just shows, dude, you've been stalking her. This is what you did. There's really no way around it. How is that person thinking they're going to somehow convince others that it wasn't them? Or is that not it at all? Are they not thinking they're going to convince others that it wasn't them? Are they thinking they're going to convince others that they were right and that people are going to see it from their twisted perspective, mm-hmm. from their broken prism?
Mm-hmm. Probably some of both. I think some of them tell themselves a story about why what they did was justified, why it was necessary. And those stories are so out of reality and so warped. It almost fits a delusion. You know, mm-hmm. they're obsessed, they're driven. But I think some of them think that they're going to be able to present the case, poke the holes in the evidence, and that ultimately they're going to win. I think when Bundy represented himself, he was just convinced. He was so charismatic and he, you know, thought he was so wonderful and could manipulate so well. He thought that he was going to get away with it, you know, mm-hmm. and sometimes I think they enjoy the process.
You know, we've talked about what maybe could have been done differently on the part of the victim, of Monique and Spencer. What about McKee? Again, assuming if it is him, he's innocent until proven guilty. Is this someone who would have responded to therapy? Is this someone who, in the right setting, could have been talked down, could have had something injected into his mind, into his way of thinking, some sort of a speed bump that would have tripped him off path to go down some other route? Or are some brains like this, you're not going to reach them?
This would have been a hard nut to crack in therapy. Really, really hard. In all likelihood, he never would have been honest with the therapist. Mm-hmm. I saw a case this week of a guy who's making very threatening online posts, and he's in therapy. And this is actually a person I know on Facebook who's got psychotic thinking. I've known him for several years, and we've talked a lot because he'll admit he's schizophrenic and has mental health problems. And he's in therapy, and he's been talking about his wonderful new therapist. So in a private message, because he's been deteriorating and getting very threatening in his posts and scaring people, and I said, how are you dealing with this with your therapist? And he goes, oh, I don't let her know. I want her to like me. And there you go. It's like, how do you work with them in therapy? It's pretty tough because we assume that people come to therapy and they're going to be honest and they're going to be collaborative. And for folks like this, that's not how they do therapy.
How do you reach someone like that who actively is, you know, who doesn't see anything wrong with this? the equation itself is clearly like, okay, well, he's going to therapy for a reason, but he doesn't seem to grasp, okay, in order for this to work, here's what needs to take place. And if he's actively choosing not to participate, a key part of it, how does he think it's, or does it matter? Is it not that it's more so for show? Is it more, I'm participating in the game, and it doesn't really matter that I'm not playing it by your rules, I'm playing it by my rules, because at the end of the game, everybody's just checking to make sure I'm playing the game, not necessarily playing it right.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think everybody around that person also has to go to therapy and say, this is what we're seeing.
This is the truth. Yeah. Yes, you nailed it. They need collateral information from other people. But a lot of times when a narcissist goes to therapy, and surprisingly, a lot of them go to therapy, but you know why they go? Because they want admiration from the therapist.
Yes.
They want validation from the therapist. And therapists who are not sharp at picking up on the cluster B stuff, and a lot of them are just, they don't pick it up. They validate them. They build their self-esteem. They tell them, oh, this, you know, crappy novel you wrote, this is wonderful. You're going to get it published someday. Think and, you know, believe in yourself, be positive. So it's actually the therapist can be making the narcissism worse by not catching it and not calling it out and not trying to intervene in it.
That's interesting. And that sounds like it would be a human error on the part of the therapist.
Very much.
Right there. How, I mean, we were kind of, you know, going on a rabbit hole here, but that's fine. Can that be improved upon with non-human therapists? Ooh, AI.
That's an interesting idea. That's one I'd like to experiment with. Thank you for that. Yeah.
Because if you take the human error out of it, as well-meaning as those therapists may be, I'm not saying like those therapists are out there, let's go, you know, enable a madman. But you only know what you know. And obviously therapy is, you know, it's a back and forth thing. You know, there is a humanistic element to it. And some will say it's very important. Some will say it's less. I mean, we've seen an interesting advent in one-on-one therapy over the, you know, really since COVID, with doing it remotely. It's just been kind of accepted thing now. It probably would have happened either way in time, but that really forced it down a lot of people's throats. What about more of an AI approach with therapy, an AI therapist that can truly respond to and pick up on some of the subtle nuances that maybe an inexperienced therapist wouldn't, or someone who only specializes in this type of therapy, but not that type of therapy. Could this be really a godsend to a lot of people? Number one, affordability-wise, accessibility-wise, and expertise-wise. I'm seeing like a three win here if it can be, you know, honed in to an effective level.
Yeah, I think it's a possibility for the future. I actually have clients now using ChatGPT between sessions, and it's very fruitful for them, you know, but they're people who are not pathological, really. They're just dealing with some anxiety, depression, a job stress situation, really normal kind of human stuff. And they will go into ChatGPT on a bad day and say, you know, had a bad day with my boss. What do you think I should do? And they're getting really good responses. But it seems like at this point, the AI, it has a bias toward being gracious and supportive and kind.
No matter what.
No matter what. And so, I mean, I asked it just as an experiment to analyze my personality. And I went, whoa, it nailed so many things. It was, I thought this is as good as the MMPI. But then I had to say specifically, okay, don't just tell me the good things. Tell me what my vulnerabilities may be. And it did a pretty good job with that. But I don't think we've programmed it adequately enough yet to pick up on narcissism and cluster B traits. And
I mean, and maybe not like as a whole and like the wholesale version of ChatGPT that's just kind of out there for everybody. But I mean, if you're doing a customized, you know, API for therapy for that specifically, and it's designed to do that. And let me ask you this too, you know, someone like Michael McKee, it seems like, you know, he was able to sit there and fester for a decade, basically. And I don't know what his therapy history is, if at all, if anything. I'm going to guess probably nothing because he's perfect. Why would he need it? Therapy typically once a week, twice a week, you know, sometimes in more extreme cases, more frequently. It's for an hour, 50 minutes at a pop. I've always wondered about that. Once a week, every other week, whatever. I mean, number one, it's usually what insurance will allow. It seems to be the reasoning as to why we're doing it at the frequency at which we do. But if you take all that out of the equation, you take what insurance says, because it's all basically AI, if we were to do it that way, would it be very beneficial to have more of a constant voice in your pocket that can support you, that can give you insight, not just in that 50 minutes that you hope you remember everything and are able to get everything out in that 50 minute moment, but you can literally pick the thing up at any time and have that conversation. Would that be beneficial to most people?
Yeah, we're doing more with texting in between sessions. If I have somebody that's having suicidal thoughts or seems very fragile, I will have them check in with me once a day just through a text. You know, let me know how you're doing. Do we need to talk more? And for somebody with like these intransigent personality disorders, let's say the goal was you will think less about your ex-wife and you will stop the ruminating. You could do a check-in every day, you know, on a 1 to 10 scale. How much ruminating have you been doing? And at least try to get them to self-monitor better. If you could get them to be honest, and that's one of the key things, would they participate and be honest?
And at the end of the day, that's the human aspect you can't control. Is the participation. But if you do have someone that is out there and they're finding results and anyone feeling, because I can't imagine it felt good to be Michael McKee for feeling this way all those years, no matter how misguided and off base he was and how he's doing it to himself, he wasn't seeing it that way. It was cause and effect. It was black and white. It was rigid. There's no gray area. There's no independent thinking. It's she did this, I feel this. And, you know, and that's how that thinking, if he did this. But if you had something like that, something AI wise that could give you exercises throughout the day that could help you get your mind off of this, because you're only one person. And I know that, and I agree. There's, you know, there's a lot of that with texting, and there is more hands on throughout the week than there used to be, but you're only one person. You don't have time every day to sit down and do in-depth sessions with them. That could do that. It could actively help people move beyond these ruminations and obsessions.
Yes.
Again, if they're able to participate.
If they'll do it. Yeah. And it's being used a lot with addiction, where you can get apps that will give you the message of the day and check in with you about your sobriety.
This is another form of addiction. You're exactly right. There are the apps for sobriety and all that. And people are finding them incredibly effective.
Yep.
This is the same sort of thing. It's an addiction to the ex. It's an addiction to the love, quote unquote. Even though it's not love, but it's the obsession. The idea of what love is for that person. I don't know. I think there could be a lot of possibilities there.
Yeah, yeah. And it's good we're opening the box up and looking at what else can be done, definitely.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just 100%. At the end of the day, when you have a mind like that, you can get the app that can get you off of that person until they find the next person. But if they have the tools in their tool belt and they realize, oh, I don't have to sit here and in their mind be the victim to whatever, however they were wronged or however they view they were wronged, that it's getting the tools in people's toolboxes early on. And and I feel like so many, we don't do that. We don't do that at all.
Yeah.
That's fascinating. Your thoughts in the comment section on YouTube or on Substack. We'd love for you to weigh in. Do check that out. Links are in the description. Let's move on to another topic here. Pastor J.P. Miller pled not guilty to federal cyberstalking charges, but the indictment reads like a textbook on coercive control, tracking devices, a nude photo posted online, 50-plus contacts in a single day, financial interference, lies to federal investigators. Micah Miller called police 14 times in her final months. She told her family if she ended up with a bullet in her head, it wasn't by her, it was JP. 2 days after serving him divorce papers, she was dead. Psychotherapist Siobhan Scott is with us to help break down the latest developments in this case. The federal indictment alleges J.P. Miller tracked Micah's car, posted nude photos of her online without consent, contacted her over 50 times in a single day, interfered with her finances, and damaged her tires, all while she was trying to divorce him. Seems like a lovely pastor, doesn't it? From your clinical experience, what does that pattern tell you about what Micah was living with on a regular basis?
Absolutely horrendous stress, you know, and that kind of stress sits in your body. People have anxiety, depression, they become hypervigilant to threat, and this affects them in every way. A lot of people get somatic symptoms, headaches, stomach problems, stress-related illnesses. This had to be hell for her. And then I want to throw in this thing about the pastor of Solid Rock Church. You know, when you look at the videos of some of his sermons and the eulogy and all this stuff, which is on YouTube, they had a room full of people that were following this guy.
Yes.
Who was clearly attention-seeking, grandiose, lacking empathy. I mean, the guy was a sicko. And yet he was charismatic enough to pull people in and consider him a man of God and to try to follow him. And it's a weird case with another layer of weird religion, which we see so much of.
And what does it say about the congregation that they didn't step back and go, wait a second, in any way, that they couldn't see any of what we're seeing of some of those sermons, I'm going to say. I mean, he had a lot of control over a lot of people.
Cult-like, again, a very cult-like figure, because he was obviously dramatic and could get people fired up. And so often we look at these people that run cults and we go, how could people not see that this guy was crazy or dangerous? And all the allegations of sex with underage girls and, I mean, and going back to his father, who I guess was the founder of the church. You know, you get these fringe religious groups and you're really apt to see this cult-like stuff happening.
Is it because religion is mixed in here? Because you get God and somehow that just erases, you know, everybody. I feel like so many people are brainwashed or given the modality in their mind that once there's a crucifix introduced into the conversation, all bets are off. It's just like, well, you were grooming her at 10 years old and then you married her at 20 something and everybody's like, oh, it's God's will. If this were, you know, any other setting, if this were in a workplace that wasn't a church, if it were at the McDonald's, if it were any place, anyone would be going, she was like a 10-year-old intern here, and now you're like that. It'd be weird, but because it's a church, like the word grooming goes out the window. It, you know, oh, he's guiding her. He's a pillar in her life. Mm-hmm. You know, all these other terms are like interchanged and interwoven, so everyone can get behind it and go, oh, it's great. Why is that? What the hell is going on in people's mind? What enables people to get behind a monster like J.P. Miller, knowing all of the shit that's public about him, and go, he seems like a great guy to lead me into eternity as my religious leader.
Yeah, desperate people can be conned pretty easily by somebody who's an adept con artist, and he clearly was. His ability to be dramatic, to get people fired up, often to probably tell people what they want to hear. It's almost like these groups, there's a seduction process with getting people in. And you have a lack of critical thinking in people who fall for this kind of stuff. And then they get the group dynamics going where they like the camaraderie of being part of the, you know, part of God's club here. And, you know, there are churches, Christian churches, other kinds of churches where you don't see the cult mentality. Be an Episcopal, be a Presbyterian.
So why
Lutheran.
Are they picking this guy? I mean, it's not like you're starving for options.
Yeah.
I mean, there's like, are people just lazy too? Or like, well, I ended up here through the Google search and I don't want to find another one. And this guy, he says God, he wears the cross. Is it, I mean, obviously charisma has a lot to do with it as well. And JP could certainly turn it on when he needs to. I'm also curious about an element of JP that he's always exuded. He's always put out there. And that's his brokenness. He hasn't really hidden. He's admitted to a lot of his faults. He's admitted to his affairs. He's admitted to seeking out prostitutes. He's admitted to cheating on his wives. I mean, it's like, and it's like one thing after another. It's not, but the thing is with him, it was never like, and that was the old me and I found God and I've changed. Right. It's like, that was the old me. It's still kind of me on Tuesdays and every other Wednesday. And right now, technically it's still me. You know, it's like it was still ongoing, but he was always pretty open about it. Is that something that's seductive to people? The vulnerability? Do people look at that and go, oh, look, he's struggling too? And people, everybody's got their own shit.
Yeah.
Is it kind of a, well, at least I'm not that bad, kind of aspect that people look at it and go, and he's godly. And he's, and so of course, if God's in the mix, God's going to make this all turn out right for him and me. Mm-hmm. And we're all broken people and we're all going to come together and find the Lord. Let's lay hands and have some donuts. I mean, is that part of this? Is that part of the bullshit?
That's a good point. I think it's weaponizing the vulnerability.
Yeah.
And you see that with a certain narcissistic type where it's almost like, look at how flawed I am. Look at how much I struggle, and therefore have more compassion and empathy for me. But then here's all the ways I'm still, you know, I'm the pipeline to God for you, and God can use damaged people. I mean, we're hearing that with politicians, right? All the time. It's like you look at the behavior and you go, this is pretty far from what we would consider Jesus's behavior. This is not godliness, but they weaponize it and they manipulate with it. And I'm sure a lot of people didn't fall for it, but he had enough that did to still fill the church.
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting point. You know, we look at it going, how would anybody get behind J.P. Miller? If they just look at the facts. I mean, and maybe they just don't look at the facts. Maybe they don't. They ignore it and they go, well, people are very quick to go, oh, well, you know, that's somebody lying. Somebody's stretching the truth. People are always really, really ready to believe that somebody is stretching the truth in order to protect not believing reality. I mean, just look at our world right now. There's far worse people than J.P. Miller out there that claim to be men of God, mm-hmm. that people are still like, oh yeah, totally man yeah. of God.
Yeah.
Have people kind of forgotten what that actually means, or have they conflated Satan for Jesus at this yeah. point?
Yeah. Yeah. I think it shows that people are not many people, we'll say half the population of humanity,
yeah. are with not, 80.
yeah, not very good at logical thinking and connecting the dots and analyzing these things. And they are very emotionally driven. They go for the person who can exploit their vulnerabilities. They make them feel a certain way. They pump them up. They feign victimhood and people start to have empathy for them. And it's one of those things that, gosh, I wish we could smarten humans up about this stuff. But they
is that learned behavior? Is that because we're not teaching people these skills? I mean, some of it probably is, you know, either you got it or you don't. But I would imagine, I mean, I just feel like nobody's prepared for anything
yeah.
at all. And nobody's yeah. prepared for logic or critical thinking. Yeah. Nobody's prepared to deal with any sort of, you know, setbacks or dealing with anything of that nature, because it makes them feel icky. I mean, we're kind of trained to do whatever's going to make us feel good in that moment. Is that really the engine that's allowing for all of this to fester in so many situations?
Yeah, I think humans, we are emotional machines that think later, but we're driven by our emotions. Not all of us to equal degree, but we're driven by our emotions and our biases based upon the emotions. And then we tend to come up with what we think are logical rationalizations for why what we feel is true. Mm-hmm. But what we feel is true is often very far from reality. And some people do better. You know, that's the prefrontal cortex thinking, that logical brain. Some people have a very robust prefrontal cortex, but that's not the majority of humans. Mm-hmm. And how do we develop that? Can you develop that in childhood? You probably can work on it. If you've got parents that are, you know, very thoughtful people who analyze, who are not so emotionally driven, they probably have better odds of teaching those skills to their kids.
And we don't do a really great job at educating people on what coercive control is, probably because a lot of people are raised by coercive control. Mm-hmm. and if that's your, you know, modality, that's all you know, that's just control. That's just life. Mm-hmm. That's how the world works. But we are seeing more recognition of coercive control being something that should be a factor in when someone unalives themselves, which is what happened here in this case. I'm not standing here saying J.P. Miller went to the swamp and shot Micah Miller. I don't think he did. I think Micah went to the swamp and shot herself. Mm-hmm. She called the police and said she was going to. She went to the store. She bought the gun. I don't think anybody swooped in midway through, took the gun from her hand and did it. She was going to do it herself, and she did. Because of distorted thinking, because she thought there was no way out and the end was going to be determined by J.P. Miller. In reality, we know that's not true, but because she was in such a dark place, that's how she saw it, because of the coercive control. Mm-hmm. South Carolina is working on some laws criminalizing coercive control. Mm-hmm. Is this something you think we're going to see more of, not only in South Carolina? I know other states do have laws with this. We've seen other cases where we saw one recently or a couple years ago where there was a young girl who basically told her friend to go kill himself, and he did. Mm-hmm. And she was charged. And I mean, that's a very direct way of doing it, where someone literally says, yeah, go do it. But that's not usually how coercive control works. It's a mm-hmm. slow build. It's making mm-hmm. someone's life hell, making it unlivable, making them see that there's no way out. And that seems to be where Micah was mentally. Is this something that we can realistically legislate and prosecute going forward?
I sure hope so. You know, it hasn't been that many years since rape in a marriage was considered legal. Right. And, you know, domestic violence laws. We didn't really have any rules about domestic violence laws, beating your wife until the 30s, 1930s. There wasn't a crime. It was just considered a family matter. So I think the kind of conversations that we're having now and the more that we read about coercive control can look like intimidation, threats, surveillance, isolation, manipulation. It's all about dominance and it affects people. It can drive them out of their mind and it's a horrible way to live. So I like to think that we're going to see those laws happen.
I hope so.
Do we need more just literally, you know, no excuse laws here? It's like, it doesn't matter your context. There's no excuse for putting a nude photo of your ex or whoever online without their consent. Yeah. I mean, that's what happened here. Do we need more just no nonsense, no excuses? You did this. Here's the consequence. You know, we don't give a shit about your excuses. It is what it is. Mm-hmm. Here's the consequence to your actions. Mm-hmm. Just cause an effect, because coercive control can be litigated. It can be litigated 1,000 ways. You're talking about someone's intent and saying, you know, someone's intent. If someone could argue on that, I accidentally loaded it. I did this. I mean, patterns obviously show a lot. Do we need courts that are just very no nonsense with this? Mm-hmm. So it becomes part of the ether. I mean, obviously we have laws. You can't kill people. You can't do this. People still do it. But the more speed bumps we put in place for behavior, will that affect behavior, I guess, is the question.
Mm-hmm. I think interrupting this kind of cycle, which, you know, it happens over time. It happens incrementally. Mm-hmm. People start at one level and then they magnify, do more, more, more. I think the sooner we can interrupt it, and yeah, having laws that allow us to interrupt it, judges that understand the severity of it, there should be more consequences earlier. And I think that would save people.
Feel like at the end, all the answers go back to better education for everybody.
Yeah.
Every person in every situation. That's our problem at the end of the day. Your thoughts in the comments section. We'd love to get them either on Substack, hiddenkillers.substack.com. The link is in the description, or on YouTube in the comments. Weigh in. We'd love to get your opinions. We read those comments and we consider them in our discussions too, especially when we continue to talk about all these cases. So please do weigh in and be sure to press subscribe wherever you're downloading podcasts so you don't miss any of our coverage of this and the many cases we got for you right here. Siobhan's latest book, Nightbird, available wherever books are sold, and your other one, The Minds of Mass Killers, right here, also available. Search and get them. Good reads. All right, until next time, for Siobhan, for Stacy, for Todd, I'm Tony Bruschi. We will talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
You ain't heard about Moto Casino? Moto has real Vegas slots. Any game you can find on the floor in Vegas, you can play it on Moto. I like my slots hot. Moto's free to play, like food stamps. In line at the grocery store, at a funeral, in traffic. Keep your eyes on the road. Hop on Moto Casino. Moto Casino got jackpots that are bigger than my belly. Moto, America's hottest free-to-play social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino,
America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends, with thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
You ain't heard about Moto Casino? Moto has real Vegas slots. Any game you can find on the floor in Vegas, you can play it on Moto. I like my slots hot. Moto's free to play, like food stamps. In line at the grocery store, at a funeral, in traffic. Keep your eyes on the road. Hop on Moto Casino. Moto Casino got jackpots that are bigger than my belly. Moto, America's hottest free to play social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Here's golf legend John Daly.
Hell yeah, these wins are piling up faster than my divorces.
I only spent on Moto, America's social casino. You know I've won a couple of majors. And on Moto, I've won majors, grands, and epic jackpots on their classic Vegas slots with huge, huge bonus rounds. Moto Casino adds new games and awards players free coins every single day. Grip it and spin it on Moto Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Hi, Uncle Laser here. America's built on fast cars, fast food, and even faster women. Moto Casino's built in America. You know what they're fast at? Fast cash prize redemption. You see, only Moto is U.S. owned and operated. Moto, it's American made. That's who we are, and that's who we care about. Play for free at Moto.us.
Moto Casino's the social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details. Must be 21 plus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Lots of places can expose you to identity theft. That's why LifeLock monitors hundreds of millions of data points a second for threats to your identity, which is way more than anyone can do on their own. If we find anything suspicious, like new loans or changes to your financial accounts, we alert you right away, all through text, phone, email, or the LifeLock app. Save up to 40% your first year. Visit LifeLock.com/iHeart. Terms apply.